Hi, everybody. My name is Jackie. I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. And I am thrilled and delighted to be here. This has been an incredible weekend for me. My home group is the Freedom from Alcohol group in Lauderdale by the Sea. And did I say that I'm thrilled and delighted? Okay. It's such an honor to be asked to do anything in AA. There was a time when no one wanted me to talk. No one would listen. And I have an incredible story. So I am really excited about being here and sharing it with you. My home group, Freedom from Alcohol, meets in Lauderdale by the Sea on Monday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. And it seems to give me everything I need. When I first got sober, my first sponsor suggested that I do these 90 meetings in 90 days, and she also suggested what types of meetings I should go to. And she said, you know, a big book meeting would be good for you, because that's our textbook, and we're going to be studying that, and you'll be studying that the rest of your life. And then she said, and a step meeting would be good for you, because we're going to be working the steps, and then you're going to be practicing the steps, and hopefully someday you'll be living the steps. And then she suggested that I have a discussion meeting focused on the solution, because we know what the problem is. And hopefully based on AA literature. And then the last one was a beginner's meeting, lest I never forget where I come from. And my home group gives me those four meetings. And I feel like it's, you know, it's my sponsor being there every day with me. I want to tell you a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. But I also want to thank everybody, the committee especially, and Kathy, for the phone call. I had been hearing about the lake since 2008, and this is my first time here. So sometimes slowly, but thank you so much. I came up to the lake tired, exhausted, a little broken. And I've learned that God is the glue again, and God speaking through all of you. And thank you for the speakers, for Matt and Michelle and Fred and everyone who chaired a workshop. I listened intently because I was taught to do that. And I heard my God speaking through you. And I have a new strength today, you know, a day at a time. And I'm more focused than I was when I arrived here on Thursday. I'm more diligent today. You know, I was doing this guided meditation for 21 days, and I was 5 days behind when I got here. So that tells you how focused I was. But I love AA each and every day. It has given me a life beyond my wildest dreams. I could not imagine living today the way I live today from where I come from. So my story is about coming from darkness into light. I was dying a day at a time from an active disease, and I had no way out. Michelle shared she had the 357. I had a car in the garage and wanted to put the rag in the tailpipe and just go to sleep. And that was my best thinking on how to solve my problem. So anyway, let me start at the beginning, and I hope I don't get stuck in childhood. Irish Catholic, one of six kids, grew up in New Jersey. My dad was a captain in the Air Force, and my mom was a nurse, and they fell in love, and she traveled around the United States with him wherever he was based, and we ended up in New Jersey. A lot of my siblings are born in Indiana and New York and all over the United States. And, you know, I know they were in love, but he was an active alcoholic. And when they talk about the ism and how it destroys families and friends and morals and relationships and dreams, you know, I saw that. Because there were times when it looked like everything was okay, and then there were times when it was absolutely disastrous. My dad was a binge drinker. He would start around St. Paddy's Day and quit after Christmas. You know, it was just the holidays, and he would get going, and he wouldn't stop. And I was daddy's little girl. I was in the bars with him all the time. I remember sitting on the bar stool and having a Coca-Cola and a bag of potato chips and listening to him. And he was truly my hero. And the difference with my dad and my mom is I would hear my dad talk to his friends about they would drink like him if they were married to a woman like her. So I grew up thinking my mom was the reason he drank. And anyway, it was probably, it was New Year's Eve, 1965, and my dad and my mom's wedding anniversary was New Year's Eve. And he wanted to take us out to see Thunderball. And he drove, he was already drinking, and he drove us to the theater, but he had to stop at a few bars on the way. And I remember being 14, my youngest brother was with us, he was 12, and I was terrified because he would go into these bars that were really shady, and I didn't think he would come out. And he finally came out of the bar, we went to the movies, and he just passed out. And on the way home, he couldn't even drive. And he was very sick. And my mom was in the back seat with him, holding him. And I drove home at 14. I actually stood up in the car and had to drive, and my brother was shaking in the front seat. But I did pretty good. But that was close to the end. He was very, very sick. And he died 10 days later. He died of cirrhosis of the liver. He bled to death. And I had no idea he was that sick. But I remember the day he passed. And I knew he was sick. He was still drinking. He could not hold anything down, and he was still drinking. And I was late for school, and I was running out the front door, and he was standing at the top of the stairs. And he said, Jackie, he said, would you come up here and help me shave? Will you help me get ready? And I said, Dad, I'm going to be late for school, and I left. And I never saw him again. And two things happened that day when I came home from school. My mom was kneeling down at the front door when I walked in with my brother, and she said the angels came and took him away. And I thought to myself, screw this stuff. I was in Catholic school. I was taught about a loving God. I didn't feel there was a loving God. And so I decided there was no God. And the second thing that happened is I thought to myself that my mom killed him. He drank because of her. And that did a terrible riff in our relationship. And I just could not grieve for my dad's death. And I just could not get along with my mom. So it was just, I was just so shut down and so full of devastation and hurt. And not knowing how to talk to somebody or how to get through that. We grew up in a house of don't talk, don't trust, don't feel. I mean, that just comes with the ism. And that ism, you know, I had that ism before I ever picked up a drink, just being the child of an alcoholic. Ism, I sabotage myself, I self me, insanely short memory, in sobriety, I sponsor myself. So I know clearly that I was tremendously affected. The good news is there is hope. There is hope to change those belief systems I had, the myths that I believed, the thoughts that I thought I knew and I was so sure of. But I did not want to be like my dad. And I swore to myself, I will never be like him. I'm never going to drink like that. I'm never going to be like that. And sure enough, I was right there. I badgered my mom when I was 16. I just was relentless about letting me quit school every day, because I was already into a lot of things, and I just didn't want to waste my time in school. I had people to see and things to do and places to go, and she finally signed me out of school at 16. At 17, I left home, and I thought I had the world at my feet, and, you know, I was doing some things that were illegal, and I wouldn't do today, of course. And money was the most important thing to me. If I had money, I had everything I wanted, whether it was other things or alcohol or whatever it was. And that was my driving force. I never considered myself homeless, but I had no address. And I did whatever I had to do to get by. I broke into cars. I drove cars for people that were breaking into the gas stations. I mean, I think about these things now, and it was like, who was that person? But I would drive them at 2 or 3 in the morning. They would get out. I would drive up and down the highway. When I saw their flashlight, I'd pick them up, and that's how I made my money. I was a B&E driver. It's unbelievable. I think about it, and it's like, who was that, you know? And the more time I have in this program, I get further and further away from that, and it seems like it wasn't even real. But it was the late 60s and into the 70s, and you know what we were all doing, and I don't want to talk about that because I have a tremendous love and respect for AA, singleness of purpose. But I was out there, and I didn't think I'd live till 22. And I had this brilliant idea. You know, my ideas are so good. And the idea was that I was going to get married. And those who know me know how absurd that was. I was going to get married. I was going to settle down. And I was going to have a normal life. And I did. And I married my drug dealer, who I knew for 6 years. And he was so insane, he signed up for Vietnam 3 times. He had 3 tours over there. But a gentle, loving man. We loved as best we could with our childhood, with our backgrounds. We just were in search of this normal living. And we did things like we went fly fishing and we went trap shooting and camping and hiking and all these outdoorsy things. And we weren't doing that other stuff, but we were drinking. But that was okay, you know. We could handle that. And we went to these no-kill fish areas and beautiful streams. And I thought, oh, this is what I always wanted, you know, to be one with the universe and be outdoorsy and healthy. And this is just a great way of life. And then, you know, the drinking just kept progressing. And we know what happens there. We were married about 2.5 years, and he had an accident at work. And he crushed his hand and needed surgery. When he came out of the hospital, he was full-blown again. And I looked at it, and I went to work every day, and I kept thinking to myself, you know, this is not good. This is not what I signed up for. And he was actually using every day. And one day I just left. I packed up a few things, and I left. I couldn't do it. I was terrified. And there I went. So my drinking really escalated. Michelle drank at the Lucky Lady. My favorite bar was the Rock Bottom Inn. And I had my bottom at the Rock Bottom Inn. Thank you, God. But my whole focus was around alcohol. All of my friends had to drink. It was better if they drank worse than me, because then I can kind of look down at them. I wasn't that bad. I drank at this bar that I lived on top of called Michael's Inn. And when they moved across the street, when they bought the building, I moved with them. They put me on third shift. I worked for this Fortune 50 company, and they said, you know, it's a terrible shift, but, you know, we want you to be there because we think you can help us, and, you know, we're moving to a new facility, and la-di-da, and I took the job, and I loved it because me and the mechanics could go out at 8 o'clock in the morning. We could drink all day. And then we would go home. I'd have to stop in the bar and say hi to everybody before I went upstairs to go to bed, and I could get by on 4 hours sleep or 3 hours sleep. And I did that day after day after day, and it was fun for me. I didn't have to feel or deal. I was numb most of the time. I had problems with my boss, though, later on. We're into the early 80s now. And my boss had a problem with me calling in sick on Fridays and Mondays. I would get paid on Thursdays. And I just couldn't stop. And I would be down at the Rock Bottom Inn, and God only knows why, but I had to cash my check there, and I had to buy my cigarettes there, and on weekends I had to have lunch there, but it was just my whole way of life. Very self-destructive, didn't see it was a problem, and I kept getting promoted at work. They thought I was great, except my boss, and so I end up with this boss who really wants me to be in work, and one thing that happened is she asked me to be the chairperson of the United Way Fund one year, and it was a big job, and I said, sure. The first thing I did was schedule all of the meetings at lunchtime off-site in restaurants that served liquor, and part of the problem was she noticed that I wasn't coming back to work after lunch, and when I say all-encompassing, it's what I thought about when I woke up. And it's what I thought about when I passed out. I'd be on the bar and it'd be like one drink, two drink, three drink floor. You know, I was just that kind of drinker. I drank for effect. I became a blackout drinker. And I just thought that was fun, you know, until it wasn't fun anymore. So my boss told me one day, she said, we're having a new program called the Employees Assistance Program. And we have a mandatory meeting on Monday morning at 8 o'clock, and you need to be there and don't be late. So I was late, I was hungover, and I know I smelled of alcohol. And I went into this large auditorium, and I went into the side door, and there she was sitting there in the front row. And our eyes met, and she just did one of these and had a seat for me. So I went in and I sat down next to her, and I'm thinking, oh, this is not good. And Employees Assistance Program, we were the second company to launch this program. And I thank God each and every day because it saved my life. But during the program, this gentleman, Bob, came out, and he talked about alcoholism and the family disease and, you know, the addiction and all of these things. And I'm thinking, Rock Bottom Inn for lunch. And, you know, when is this going to be over? And they showed a film. And in the film, there's this white-collared worker, and, you know, he's in an office, and he's in charge of a committee, and he's screwing up. Goes out, doesn't come back after lunch. But there was one excuse he used in this movie, and I just used it on my boss, like that Friday. And she just looked at me. And I saw her looking, and I kept looking straight ahead, and beads of perspiration were coming off my forehead. And a couple of things happened. I drank a little more. I had an idea that the rag in the tailpipe might be a good idea. And I can't tell you if I dreamt that or if I was laying in bed thinking it. But it scared the bejeebies out of me. I called Bob, and I was on a weekend tear, and I called him on. I called in sick first, and my boss said, "What else is new?" Then I called Bob, and I said, "You know, I can't do this. I can't stop." And he says, "Well, come into my office." And I said, "No, I called out sick today. I can't come in. You wouldn't believe what I look like. I can't come in." And he said, "I'll meet you at a diner at 2 o'clock this afternoon." And I met with him. And I was beaten down and broken and couldn't even look at him and sobbing and felt terrible. And he said, "Go on home. I'll call you later." So I went home. And I mean, I'm desperate. I just want to feel better. And he calls me and he said, "Listen, I can get you into Carrier Clinic or Fair Oaks. These great rehabs in New Jersey, no problem." And I said, "Do you have any further away?" Right? I'm dying, and I'm picking and choosing where I want to go for treatment. The insanity of this disease. And he did. He had this incredible place called Falkirk. It's not there anymore, and no one's ever heard of it. Saved my life. He said, "Can you go tomorrow?" And I said, "Yes." And I had a friend take me up, my bartender. And I felt like I had died and a new me was born. They said things in that treatment center that just were amazing to me. Like, if you don't take one drink, you won't get drunk. and there's a way out. And you never have to feel this way again. So I don't know, you know, it was this God that I didn't know, even know I had. You know, I had renounced God for years, and but there was good orderly direction. And I swore, I had 4 weeks there, and then they heard my story. They asked me to tell my life story, and they said, oh my God, you're an addict too. You got to stay 2 extra weeks. I said, great. I had figured out that I was going to work up there. I was going to move up there. I thought it was the facility that was the reason why I was feeling so good. And I was terrified to leave it. And I didn't want to leave. And they had this program, Family Care, where one day when you're getting close to leave, that you invite the family up. And I didn't want my family to come. I was so separate from my family, and I did not want to see my mom. Then my boss called and wanted to know if I would let her come up. Ugh. You know, I didn't want that either. But I said yes to everybody. And here's the power of the program. So Dr. Stuckey, who was the owner of the rehab, told his life story during this family care meeting. And all of us little inmates were in the first couple of rows, and behind us was the families and friends. And he said, when he was done, would all the real alcoholics in this room please stand up? And my oldest brother's chair moved, and he stood up. I had not a clue, and he hasn't had a drink since. Cindy, my boss, was in that room. And 15 years later, she remembered what she heard, and it saved a family member. Because she knew what to do. So it was just, my mom, of course, wanted to know how my tennis game was. You know, but I told her we didn't really have time for tennis. But even before I heard about the 12 steps and started to recover, they asked me to read this chapter from a book. And the author is Og Mandino. And it's called The God Memorandum. And it starts out, it's to you from God, and it starts out, take counsel. I hear your cry. Huh. So this was my reintroduction to a higher power. And I loved it. It took 20 minutes to read, and I walked around with it in rehab in my hands. And every time I had 5 minutes or 15 or 20 minutes, I would just read it. Even if I couldn't finish it, I would just read a little more. And some of the things that it said towards the end, 5 important things, and these were the lessons I first had, even before the steps. Count your blessings. Proclaim your rarity. Go the extra mile. And that really helped me out with my work ethic. Use wisely the power of choice. And do all things with love. Love for yourself and love for each other. Well, that was incredible to me. It touched me like nothing has ever touched me. And I took that and I said, I'm all in. I'll do whatever you guys want me to do because I wanted to feel those things. So time to go home. I got a sponsor. I did 90 in 90. I probably did 180 in 90, to tell you the truth. They asked me to come back for the aftercare program at Falkirk, so I drove 2 hours every day. It was in New York State, or every weekend. And then I would have an hour group meeting, and then I would have an AA meeting up there. I'd get home about 3. I've had an AA meeting there about 4:30 in Oldwick, and then I would have another meeting that night. I couldn't get enough of it. It was the first time in my life I felt like I was capable. I could be honest, that I really wanted it, that it was something I could believe in. My sponsor was the most incredible role model I could have ever picked. When I asked her to sponsor me, she said 4 words, I would be delighted. And she's taught me to say those 4 words. And she was just unbelievable. She helped me see a lot of these myths about my mom. She was more of a mom than my mom was at the time. And she just taught me about love and forgiveness. And she never said that I had to do anything. It was more like, have you thought about this? So I had that first step. I had the powerlessness and the unmanageability. My life was reeking of it. My thoughts were unmanageable. My emotions were unmanageable. I came to believe in a higher power, but it was a group of drunks in recovery. It was the rooms of AA. I hadn't gotten to where I had a God of my own. But she said I could use her God. And I knew her God was good to her. I could see her life. And then turning my will and my life over, all I knew is what she suggested. I could take all of my problems and tribulations and put them in a hot air balloon, put them in the basket, and pull that rope and let them go. And if I had to put myself in there, that I could do that too. And when she went to listen to my fourth step, I was terrified. You know, I was so shame-based growing up in the alcoholic home. And I was so void of just, you know, common sense and things that I was just lacking in. But I thought if she really knew who I was, she just wouldn't be able to work with me. So I was supposed to take her to Lowe's that day, and by that time I got rid of a 2-seater car and I bought a 9-passenger station wagon. It was the AA go-to-meeting car, and I could pack 13 people in with the seats down. And that's what I used to go to meetings, and I would just love picking up people. It would take me like 4 hours to pick everybody up and bring them home. But boy, did we have fun, and we laughed, and that fellowship and that camaraderie was unbelievable. So she said, we need your station wagon. We have to go to Lowe's. I'm going to garden. You know, would you help me? And I said, sure. So we load up the car. We're driving back, and it's the day I'm doing my fifth step with her. And I start telling her my fourth step because I'm driving and I don't have to look at her. And she stopped me. And she said, don't you think it might be nicer if we go home and have a cup of tea and sit and chat for a while? And I just had this feeling that this is going to be good. So we went back to her house, and it was hours and hours and hours later. And I would share, and she would talk to me, and she would share, and it was just an incredible experience for me. And I remember when I took out my mom's stuff that I had written. I typed it. It was typewritten. Everything else was handwritten, but my mom's stuff was typewritten. I could barely read it because I was crying so much when I was typing. The pain was so intense. But after we shared and we had a couple of cups of tea, it was dark out. It was time to go home. She told me what to do. She read from the big book. Go home. Look at that first 5 proposals. Make sure nothing's left unturned. And I went back. I was driving home. And I swear, it was an out-of-body experience for me. I swear that I was just free and light as a feather. So I was all in. I wanted more and more and more. So going into the 6th and 7th step, I was a character with a lot of defects. I remember going to a meeting in Provincetown, and I used to take my big book, and I would take notes if anybody was speaking and things struck me. And I remember, and I still have the book, and it says, don't take anything that doesn't belong to you. I mean, I was that sick that I had to realize that, you know, it wasn't good for me to give away company furniture. You know, there was just a lot of things that I was still doing, and then the realizations came that I had to change even more and more and more, and I was there. There came a point, I was sharing at a meeting, and I was talking about God, and there came a point where I was just so upset that I didn't have this God of my understanding, and I longed for it. And my friend Lou shared after, he said, all you have to do is know you're not God. And then after the meeting, he gave me a book called Not God, and I read it, and it helped me so much. There was no more denying. I could not deny this God of my understanding. I could not deny that something greater than myself had carried me through all of these precarious situations. I should not have been alive with some of the things. Most of my associates, folks from the 70s, were gone. One was decapitated in a drunken car accident. One was shot by the New Jersey State Police. One OD'd behind a diner. I mean, these were folks I hung out with. So I just wanted my relationship with God. And one thing that I had to do was I had to keep continuing to do the work. I had to make the list of the amends. I had to go back. I had to search. Some of it was very obvious, but I did the four sheets from the big book. I did resentments, fears, harms done others, and sexual harms done others, just like my sponsor told me. And then when I went to do the eighth and the ninth step, the harms done others and the sexual harms done others were the first sheets that I looked at and used. And God, in all his mercy, gave me 21 years of sobriety to be with my mom, to realize how wrong I was. And as she progressed and aged, I was there for her. I was her best friend. I was a loving daughter. I asked her for forgiveness. I can't tell you how many times I said, Mom, I was wrong when. I ran away from home. I stole the car. You know, I was just wrong. And the idea that just from hearing my dad talk negatively about my mom, that could impact me that much was unbelievable. So as she aged, I was able to be there for her and move her from her home to an apartment, to assisted living, I left work for 2 years so I could take care of her. And it was only when I couldn't get her out of the bathtub that I had to go to a nursing home. And then, you know, my siblings were so grateful that I was able to do as much as I could do. So when she developed dementia and severe dementia, and she was in the nursing home, my company asked me to relocate to Florida. And I talked to my oldest sister, who's 5 years older than me, and I said, Pat, I said, it's not great timing, but how do you feel if I relocate to Florida and you take care of Mom in the nursing home? And she said, oh my God, I would love to. I was so engrossed in taking care of my mom, I wasn't letting anybody else in to help. And it was such a lesson. So I took the job and I transferred down to Florida, and they flew me home twice a month to see my mom. And as time went on, her dementia got worse and worse. My sister was with her every day. My brothers were there. And I would come and I would visit her in the nursing home. And this one day I said, I was there about 5 hours. I went from Newark Airport right to the nursing home. About 5 hours. And then I called my sister to tell her I was coming up to the house to stay with her. And she said, how's Mom? And I said, well, I have good news and I have bad news. I said, the bad news is she doesn't have any idea who I am. She has not a clue. And she said, oh, I'm so sorry, Jackie. She said, what's the good news? And I said, she really likes me. We were in the dining room, and she was just laughing and laughing and rubbing my hands, and it was such a thing. It was such a beautiful thing. And then I think back about this, you know, the thoughts and beliefs that I had, and this is what is so incredible to me, is how wrong I was, and no one could tell me any different. And then to have that moment in recovery when you realize, wow, and then able to make a difference and make amends and really tell my mom what I thought and how I felt. I have nothing left unsaid when she passed. There was nothing left. It was all said, and all my actions were there. So that is a gift. And I, you know, I have these days where I think, if nothing else changes, what a remarkable ride. You know, to be a woman of dignity and honor today, full of self-knowledge, self-control, and self-respect, to be one among many, to care about others, to feel the love in these rooms, you know, to be able to say, I can do that. I want to help. when all it was about me for years. You know, to be honestly able to say I love everyone, each and every one in this room, and to care about everybody, and to want for them what I would want for myself. That's amazing. You know, that's a transformation from where I was and who I was. So what I do today to stay sober is the same thing I do when I got sober, or I did when I got sober. My retreat leader, Sister Maurice, always used to say, you know, this gift of sobriety is a shiny ball, you know, and it's bright and it's brilliant, and it's up to each and every one of us to keep it that way, to keep it buffed and in prime condition, and not to let it sit in a corner and tarnish and get dark. So normally, what I do every day is the same thing. I get up, I read books. I have collected books around my journeys, and I have about 8 books that I read, and it sounds like a lot, but I don't want to give up that book because my sponsor gave that, and I don't want to give up God Calling because my mom wrote in it. She actually read it and wrote in it, so that's very special, and 24 hours a day and day by day, and these are all things that I have to read each and every day, and when I don't, I get tarnished. You know, I just am not brilliant, I'm not shiny, and I'm not doing what I need to do. I have the ability to sponsor a lot of women because I'm retired. I retired at 58. And from this company that kept me for 35 years and sent me to treatment and gave me a second chance at life. This company that kept promoting me and asked me to do things, even though I was stealing furniture for them or doing whatever I did. And I had to make amends for that. And I had to tell people I did that. I had to tell a vice president what I did. Because that freedom that I got from my fifth step that night is the same freedom I want to hold on to each and every day. I don't want anything tarnishing my soul. I have a God in my life today that I never dreamed possible, a loving God. I have not gone back to the church I was raised in. I do go on occasion with my family and when my sister visits and things like that. I'm still searching, you know. I do that daily 10th step. I try to keep my soul bright and clean and not hold anything that can hurt me. And that 11th step, when I'm a seeker, in my prayer and meditation, He always answers me. Always. It could be yes, no, or not yet, but He always answers me. And it's the time that I connect that is my best time. When I get up and I read On Awakening, my day is set. I read a lot of passages out of the big book. And some are obvious, you know, the third step, the seventh step, On Awakening. But I read on page 63, the bottom of page 62. Well, I start with self-seeking on page 62. I read it all the way down to the bottom. And when it talks about He is the Father and we are the children, He is the principle. When it talks about that, the next paragraph talks about if you get these ideas in your mind, remarkable things will happen, and they have. So I read that every day because I want to be reminded of that. And then on page 100, and this helps me with my sponsees, when we walk hand in hand, well, it doesn't say hand in hand, when we walk together, down that path towards spiritual enlightenment. Doesn't say that either, but I'm paraphrasing. Remarkable things will happen. So when someone is sick and suffering and needs help, I have a primary purpose. I do the best I can. My sponsor, who's also my Al-Anon sponsor, he saved my life. Al-Anon teaches me how to live it and take exquisite care of myself. And I'm still learning how to do that. She said that I can sponsor, because I don't have a full-time job, a lot of women. But I can't go over a certain amount. And I keep going over that certain amount. And now I'm learning to say, I'm not available right now, but I know someone who is. And I'm trying to do the same thing my sponsor did. So when I first went to her woman's meeting, and she met me, she had her friends in a circle. And they were all discussing with me standing there who was going to take me to a meeting on Monday, who was available Tuesday and who was available Wednesday. And they were talking like I wasn't even there. But that's what they used to do. That's the fellowship. And she was a great teacher. I've had many remarkable people in my life. God's put them there. I was at a meeting one time, and this guy knew that I was kind of anti-God early on, and he gave me a holy card after the meeting. And the holy card had this baby in these giant hands, and it said, "See, I have not forsaken you. I have carved you in the palm of my hands." And that's what my God has done for me. And I really believe as long as I'm doing his work well, I'll be okay. I haven't thought about a drink 35 years next month. I haven't wanted to get high. I haven't wanted to hurt myself. I haven't had the self-loathing or I haven't had any of those things I grew up with. I went from there's just too many kids in the family, that's the problem, to, you know, what can I do next, you know? I really appreciate the fact that I was able to share today, and I hope I gave you an idea of what it was like and what happened and what it's like today. And I just hope God gives me this gift, you know, until my last breath, because it's my life. It really is. I love AA each and every day, and thank you all for listening.